I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in the 1950s, as the Cold War with the Soviet Union was heating up, the CIA became convinced that the country that could control the mind would dominate the world. It began a top-secret program that came to be known as MKUltra and hired a chemist named Sidney Gottlieb, who was given free rein to experiment on unwitting subjects. These were prisoners in the United States and overseas, patients, addicts, even Johns, using LSD. LSD and toxins and harsh interrogation techniques learned at Nazi concentration camps in what boiled down to psychological torture. Our guest, Stephen Kinzer, details this shocking and sordid story in his new book, Poisoner in Chief. It's also full of fascinating asides, including the fact that at one time Gottlieb bought up the world supply of LSD and ended up turning on the counterculture, people like Timothy Leary and Ken Kesey and Allen Ginsberg. While MKUltra was shut down, Gottlieb's legacy survived. Some of his techniques were used at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay and other detention sites. Stephen Kinzer joins us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. He's a columnist at the Boston Globe. He's also a fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. This is, I believe, his 10th book. And Stephen Kinzer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always good to be here.
You're very welcome. Let's begin with Gottlieb's childhood. He was the son of immigrants growing up in the Bronx in New York. Is there anything about his childhood that would reveal what he would become as an adult?
You're right that Gottlieb was so different from the other people who joined the early CIA. Most of them were silver spoon aristocrats from the American elite who knew each other from prep schools and investment banks and so forth. Gottlieb was so different from that. So he was the child of Orthodox Jewish immigrants from Central Europe. He grew up in an environment that was almost entirely made up of kids like that. Also, he had a couple of disabilities. He stuttered, and he had a limp as he was born with a couple of club feet, and his mother had to carry him around until he was about 8 years old. Nonetheless, instead of withdrawing into his shell or becoming fearful or hostile as some other kids might. He became determined to succeed. He went to City College. They didn't have the right kind of chemistry courses he wanted to take, so he went on to graduate school, finally got his PhD from Caltech. So I think he did feel he had something to prove. He, of course, came out of the immigrant experience, and that was an experience that made him deeply grateful to the United States. There might have been another factor that led him to consider it acceptable to carry out these great extreme excesses in the name of patriotism. During World War II, he volunteered for military service but was turned down because of his limp. This greatly affected him, and he, after the war, wanted to do something for the United States to show that he could be just as patriotic as anyone else. When the CIA called and asked him to become the chief chemist and direct its new mind control program, he was ready to do whatever it required.
I do want to get to MKUltra, but just another personal question. He married a woman named Margaret Moore. They lived in a log cabin in the woods. I'm not sure they had running water. They raised goats. He was a family man. You quote her as saying at some point, "I feel guilty sleeping when her husband has to milk the goat." So he lived in this really sort of off-the-grid kind of family life while working eventually at the CIA.
So there were two things that made him so different from everybody else at the CIA. One was this personal background that I just described to you. But you're right. The other one was the way that he lived. He was a kind of a proto-hippie. I have a feeling that of everybody who worked for the U.S. government in Washington in the 1950s, Sidney Gottlieb must have been the only one who lived in a cabin in the woods and got up before dawn to milk his goats to make yogurt. So he considered himself a humanist, a deeply spiritual person. He meditated. He studied Buddhism. He wrote poetry. Yet he carried out the most intense and extreme experiments on human beings that have ever been carried out by any agency or official of the U.S. government. So he had the Jekyll and Hyde thing going in a big way.
Well, and this was, of course, after World War II, when there were crimes against humanity by the Nazis, by the Japanese, what they did to prisoners, to POWs. China was using germ warfare. So there was this, on the one hand, this call for, you know, never again will we treat people the way they were treated during World War II. And yet here we have Gottlieb and others and the CIA borrowing some of these techniques in order to do mind control experiments.
It's true. So not only did MKUltra, the CIA mind control program, absorb some of the ideas that had come from experiments in Nazi concentration camps, but the CIA actually hired some of those Nazi doctors and their Japanese counterparts to help design these extreme and grotesque experiments, and even perhaps in some cases to oversee them, to help monitor them. So, in many ways, the experiments that the CIA was carrying out to try to find a way to destroy a human mind and body and soul were just continuations of the ones that the same Nazi doctors now working for the CIA had been carrying out in the concentration camps.
It's interesting to think about the what psychology and psychiatry was interested in at this point, and the idea of brainwashing, that you could, you know, take someone's brain and essentially sort of eliminate all evidence of memory and personality and then try to sort of construct something new inside their head.
In the course of researching this book, I did talk to some neurologists and asked them about the reality of mind control, and they were unanimous in scoffing at it. Even back in the 50s, when this project was underway, there were a number of prominent psychologists who told the CIA quietly that this was all a fantasy. So I asked myself, what was it that led the CIA to be so open to this idea, which in the end, even Gottlieb himself had to concede was a myth.
Right.
So I think two factors played into the CIA's willingness to believe the mind control fantasy. One was a couple of incidents that actually happened in the early Cold War, which the CIA misinterpreted. At one point, the Roman Catholic prelate of Hungary was put on trial by communist authorities, and he confessed to crimes that he hadn't committed, obviously, and he spoke in a monotone, and his eyes were glazed. It later turned out that he had been coerced by normal methods that people have been using for centuries. But the CIA didn't see that. They were sure that somehow the communists had found a way to control his mind, and they were speaking through him. And then, around the same time, American prisoners who had been captured in the Korean War turned out to have written statements, in many cases, criticizing the United States, confessing to committing war crimes in Korea, which we said we had never committed. Some even wanted to stay behind. And so in order to explain this aberrant behavior, the CIA concluded these people had been brainwashed. Their minds had been seized. But I thought that might not be enough to explain it. What created the fertile ground in the minds of these CIA officers to made them believe this fantasy? And I think it has a lot to do with the fiction of mind control. All those Edgar Allan Poe stories and Sherlock Holmes stories and movies like Gaslight and Svengali, the trope of mind control has been a favorite of fantasists over many generations, and you can see why. So somehow at the CIA, they transposed this fantasy into reality. They just presumed that what imaginary fiction writers and screenwriters and short story writers could come up with in their heads, science could make real.
Well, let me play a clip from The Manchurian Candidate. This is actually a movie that came out in 1962 in which a doctor with communist China is demonstrating to their government he has just brainwashed U.S. Army soldiers.
Allow me to introduce our American visitors. I must ask you to forgive their somewhat lackadaisical manners, but I have conditioned them, or brainwashed them, which I understand is the new American word, to believe that they are waiting out a storm in the lobby of a small hotel in New Jersey, where a meeting of the Ladies' Garden Club is in progress.
So, Stephen Kinzer, during the Cold War, then this idea that if you could somehow control the mind of people, you could win the Cold War?
Exactly. Alan Dulles, the early director of the CIA who ran it for most of the 1950s, was fascinated with the idea of mind control. He truly believed that if you could find the secret to make people behave the way you wanted them to behave all over the world, the prize would be nothing less than global mastery. Other CIA successes of the early Cold War, like overthrowing the government of Iran or overthrowing the government of Guatemala, would pale into insignificance if you could get this done. And of course, he was right. If you could find a way to do that, that would be a key to absolute power. But he allowed himself to believe this was possible. And not only that, that the Soviets were getting to the point where they actually had perfected this or were perfecting it. So he allowed himself to be persuaded or persuaded himself that this was the project most urgent in the entire U.S. government, and that the life or death of the United States, and indeed the possibility of all meaningful life on Earth, depended on whether this project could succeed. And that's why he gave it the name MK Ultra. To him, it was the Ultra Project, nothing more important than this. And that's why Sidney Gottlieb was given so much power to act on his own. As I realized while researching this book, he really was the most powerful unknown American of the 20th century.
Was he a sadist?
I don't think he was, but he might as well have been because of what he did. Somehow he was able to disassociate himself from the pain that he caused on so many people. And not only that, he was able to live this other life as a self-satisfied, compassionate humanist. So Gottlieb never confided his thoughts to paper. And in a way, this biography is the biography of a man who wasn't there. Gottlieb was so invisible while he was alive that it's hard to know what he was thinking. So I've asked myself, of course, what would have allowed him to do this? I think maybe Gottlieb lost sight of this ultimate moral question. Is there any amount of evil that you can do in pursuit of what you think is a good cause that's too much so that the evil begins to outweigh the good? I think he lost sight of that. And also, I think he's an illustration of the fact that commitment to a great cause is the greatest explanation or excuse or motivation for committing immoral acts. And patriotism is among the most seductive of causes. Therefore, I think patriotism allowed him to get carried away and think that although the United States normally would not do anything like this, the exigencies of that particular moment were so great that the loss of a few lives or even a few hundred lives would be nothing compared to the threat we face. And that is also a message we should think about today, because now we're also being told that because of the special threats we face, we have to do certain things in the world we might not like, and we have to surrender certain civil liberties. So each generation produces this set of reasons why at this moment we can't be the noble, good, ethical nation that we always would be under normal circumstances. And I think Gottlieb really is an example of someone who got caught up in that moral calculation.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Stephen Kinzer is our guest on Radio Times today. He's got a new book. It's called Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Just a quick recap here. Back in the 1950s and 60s during the Cold War, the CIA was conducting secret and brutal mind control experiments on unwitting subjects. Our guest Stephen Kinzer tells us about MK Ultra, the chemist Sidney Gottlieb, who ran the project. And again, his book is called Poisoner in Chief. Let me play a clip from a declassified CIA experiment called Treating Psychosis. This is from 1955. The administrator of the test is introducing his experiment where he administers LSD to a subject in order to induce psychosis, in order to experiment with chemicals that can reverse the effects. Let's give it a listen.
On the first experimental day, Ronnie, age 22, and weighing 75 kilograms, was given 100 gamma of LSD-25 in distilled water orally. This is a very small quantity of LSD-25, but all investigators report that it is enough to produce a temporary psychotic dissociation state in any healthy adult.
So, Kevin, Stephen, let's talk in detail about then MKUltra. So it was using things like toxins and LSD, hallucinogens, even extreme interrogation techniques in order to sort of understand how the mind worked. Help us understand some of the more egregious experiments that were done.
Gottlieb, with a good scientist's mind, decided that before you could find a way to insert a new mind into somebody's brain, you first had to blast away the mind that was in there. These horrific MKUltra experiments were aimed mainly at finding a way to do that. How do you destroy a human mind and a human body and a human spirit? Gottlieb tried all manner of different drug combinations and other extreme techniques, as you mentioned. So in the United States, his subjects were usually prisoners for obvious reasons. I came across one MKUltra experiment carried out in a prison in Kentucky in which seven African-American inmates were segregated into a cell and then given triple doses of LSD every day for 77 days. This was a kind of experiment that Gottlieb carried out in order to find out if such a massive dose could blow away someone's mind. And in many of these experiments, of course, the answer came back yes. So he did succeed in destroying countless minds, and we don't even know the number of people who died under his experiments. But he was never able to do the second part, that is, to insert a new mind into the resulting void. In Europe, Gottlieb's experiments were even more intense because he didn't have what was charmingly described as the disposal problem.
Disposable so over there, patients.
Yeah, so he didn't have to worry if he experimented someone to death what to do with the body. In Europe and in East Asia, he carried out experiments on people who were called expendables. So these would be captured, suspected foreign agents or refugees not connected to anybody who would notice their disappearance. In East Asia, many of the subjects were captured North Korean prisoners of war. While I was researching this book, I found what I think may be the very first CIA secret prison in a lovely chalet outside Frankfurt in Germany. And the young German businessman who owns it was nice enough to take me through. He took me into the basement where he has his storage rooms, and he says these were the cells where the CIA doctors and their Nazi partners carried out experiments that were just continuations of the experiments that these Nazi doctors had conducted just down the road only a few years earlier at the concentration camps. And he also said to me, the older people that live around here all know what happened in this house. And in fact, I found an article in Der Spiegel, the German magazine, about this house saying this was the CIA torture house. There were deaths, but the number is not known. And this guy said to me, the people in the neighborhood have told me that the bodies of the people who died under Gottlieb's MKUltra experiments were buried in forests right around here in places that are now all covered up with shopping malls apartment blocks. So it's a known phenomenon there over many years. And these were the places, like that house in Frankfurt, where Gottlieb used to take his victims. So imagine, he had the right to requisition human subjects from government and police and military agencies and then do whatever he wanted to them in the pursuit of this goal, finding the tool to mind control. And these were experiments that were certainly the most extreme ever carried out, and they represent the most intense and systematic effort ever launched in history to find the tool of mind control, only to find out in the end, as Gottlieb was forced to conclude, that there is no such thing.
Well, it reminds me of the black sites that were identified during the Iraq War, during the Bush administration, where people could be, frankly, tortured, but not in the United States, but in some foreign country.
You're absolutely right. And in MKUltra, Gottlieb took particular interest in using bases and secret detention sites in countries which the U.S. effectively controlled. Don't forget that the United States had an occupation government in West Germany and then very close relations with the West German government. Same thing in Japan, in South Korea, in the Philippines. These are all places where some of these extreme experiments were carried out. Now, you mentioned LSD. That was one of the drugs that Gottlieb was fascinated by. And he became something like the first LSD guru. And as you mentioned at the beginning, in 1953, Gottlieb persuaded the CIA to buy the entire world supply of LSD. He really thought this could be, as one of his fellow chemists put it, the key that would unlock the universe. They thought maybe LSD was the mind control breakthrough drug. And so in addition to using LSD for all these horrifically coercive experiments that undoubtedly destroyed many minds, Gottlieb used another part of his stash for a different kind of experiment. Those were volunteer, non-coercive experiments in which ordinary people would be asked to come in and told that they were being given a psychoactive drug that was being researched and maybe paid a small sum of money, and then their reactions would be recorded. Now, the hospitals and clinics that carried out these experiments had no idea that the so-called medical foundation that had contacted them and gave them the contract and sent them the LSD was actually the CIA. But through those LSD experiments, LSD began to leak out of the CIA and leak out of laboratories. Among the first people who volunteered to take LSD in Gottlieb's MKUltra experiments were, for example, Ken Kesey, the guy that wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and the poet Allen Ginsberg, and Robert Hunter, the guy who was the lyricist for The Grateful Dead. They all told their friends, go in and try this stuff. And Kesey even got a job at the hospital so he could steal the vials of LSD and bring them home for parties. So, in a sense, as these people all realized decades later, Gottlieb was an unwitting godfather of the whole LSD-fueled counterculture. And, of course, the irony being that the drug that Gottlieb and the CIA thought might give them the key to controlling people's minds wound up fueling a generational rebellion that was aimed at destroying everything the CIA stands for.
Such a perverse and unexpected turn in this particular story. And you do quote Gottlieb. He took LSD, obviously knowing what he was taking, and he found it to be euphoric. But I'm just trying to imagine being given a high dose, and you mentioned these African-American prisoners given a dose 2, 3, 4 times the sort of normal, regular amount. What if you don't know what you're taking and then your mind just goes bonkers, what that must be like for that person?
That's really a horrific thing to think about.
It
what can happen to a person's mind who being given triple doses of LSD while locked in a cell every day for 77 days and not being told anything about what's being done to you? So who were those seven people? We don't know. The protocols were all destroyed. We don't even know their names. And I've reflected so often, maybe they even probably lived their whole lives and died without ever realizing what had happened to them and that the CIA was behind it. So these kinds of horrific experiments in which people were given no opportunity for anything remotely resembling free choice are clear violations of the Nuremberg Code. And we had hanged people at Nuremberg, Nazi doctors, for committing the same acts that MKUltra scientists committed only a few years later.
You really focus on the CIA, but it just must be said that Donald Cameron, who was the head of the American Psychiatric Association, the Canadian Psychiatric Association, and others who were, you know, professionals in their field, were proponents and even supporters of MKUltra. You quote it was a New York allergist by the name of Harold Abramson. He got money from Gottlieb, and you write that he that 12 pre-puberty boys were fed psilocybin and 14 children between the ages of 6 and 11 diagnosed with schizophrenia were given 100 micrograms of LSD each day for 6 weeks. I mean, that is absolutely horrifying.
It really is, and I think it shows you something about the madness of that era, but it also tells you something about the human mind. You can get yourself into a position where you can justify almost anything. I think there was a moment later on in life when Gottlieb was asked in a congressional investigation about the extremes that he went to, and he said, I want you all to know that I found this work very unpleasant. Very difficult, but very necessary given the needs of the time. So you can get yourself into a position, as Sidney Gottlieb definitely did, of believing that even the most horrific abuse is justified. And I should add this. Why wasn't anybody watching over Sidney Gottlieb? Why was he allowed to carry out these wild experiments with essentially no supervision at all? I don't think it was an accident.
Well, do you think because of Richard Helms and Alan Dulles and others who were 100% in support of this?
Yes, and I would take it one step further. Those people you mentioned who were senior officers at the CIA fully supported what Gottlieb was doing. In fact, they're the ones that hired him and told him essentially, go out and do whatever you have to do. But the other piece of what they effectively told him was, and don't tell us what you're doing. Hmm. People like Alan Dulles and Richard Helms in particular would have had a pretty good idea that what Sidney Gottlieb was doing was awful, it was bloody, people were dying, and therefore, unlike you or me, who might have a subordinate doing something very dicey and we'd want to follow that person's actions very closely, they did the opposite. They don't want to know anything about it. This way, they avoid all institutional responsibility. And later on, they can say, as one of the future CIA directors did say when confronted by the family of one of Gottlieb's victims, some of our people were out of control in those days. There were problems of supervision.
Hmm.
So in the CIA culture, which I think is probably also the culture of other secret services, ignorance can often be an asset. You don't want to know a lot of things. And therefore, it was possible at the end to essentially put it all on Sidney and say he went out of control. At the time, I think those people like Helms and Dulles knew that they were one day going to be saying that, but that the exigencies of the moment required that they let Sidney Gottlieb go out and do whatever he wanted, and what he wanted turned out to be pretty gruesome.
Don't they call that plausible deniability?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, talking about sort of how far afield he went, this is Sidney Gottlieb, he hired a guy named George Hunter White, who was a detective, I guess, of some sort, also into S&M and sexual fetishes, and hooked him up as kind of running some prostitution rings in order to, again, see what would happen if someone, and I guess an unwitting John in this instance, was given some kind of psychotropic drug and what happened to them as they were being observed.
This was one of the most bizarre MK Ultra projects. Gottlieb had 149 of what he called sub-projects. And this one that he set up in San Francisco was really at the outer edge. So he hired this federal narcotics agent, George Hunter White, who was also a great libertine and loved using all the drugs that he threw people like Billie Holiday into jail for using. And he set up, he asked White, who was then posted in San Francisco, to put together a ring of prostitutes and have them bring their Johns back to an apartment that they would rent and set up and decorate as a kind of national security bordello. In that room, the girls would feed the guys drinks which had been laced with either LSD or whatever drink or whatever drug Gottlieb wanted to test that week. And meanwhile, this fat George Hunter White would sit behind a one-way mirror drinking martinis out of a pitcher, sitting on his portable toilet, and make little notes about what was happening in the other room. And the idea being that maybe the combination of sex and various drugs would be something that would make people speak more freely. And let's see how these different drugs could work in coordination with sex. So this was essentially your tax dollars at work as the CIA is trying to find a way to protect America from communism. And, of course, they gave this wonderful name. This project was called Operation Midnight Climax. That shows you the level of clinical seriousness with which this operation was carried out. But also you have to think back to the people who would have been the victims. These men would have had no idea of what had happened to them. And, of course, no ability to complain afterward, which was the whole idea. And you can imagine some of them might have had some terrible episodes later on. But it was always their policy never to follow up and never to offer the slightest explanation of what might have happened to any of their victims.
Well, I'm assuming most Johns are whatever happens after some kind of sexual encounter is going to keep that to themselves. It's not like they're going to go to the cops or tell their spouse that they're not feeling so good.
That's exactly the calculation that Gottlieb made. So here's where you have this amazing project where the CIA is hiring and paying hookers to bring men back to an apartment, which is decorated in this kind of bordello chic with Toulouse-Lautrec paintings and red mirrors. So Gottlieb really went to every extreme in his bizarre efforts to try to find something that in the end he had to confess did not exist.
Did Gottlieb have sex with prostitutes?
He did. You know, this came out in one of the depositions that I found. Towards the end of Gottlieb's life, some of the walls started closing in on him, even after he'd retired from the CIA. It became clear about 20 years after MK Ultra was at its peak that something like that had existed. And several lawsuits were filed by people who came to conclude that they might have been among his victims. One of the guys who worked in this national security bordello at Operation Midnight Climax gave a deposition in which he said that every time Sidney Gottlieb came to San Francisco, I had to find him a girl. He was crazy for that. And then the guy added very proudly, but I want you to know that none of those girls ever charged him at all. That was a favor to me. So Gottlieb had a nice perk out there in San Francisco, which might give you one example, depending on how you like to play this out, for why he would have kept a project like this going or why he would have started it in the first place.
Indeed. And that's Stephen Kinzer, our guest on Radio Times today. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And we're talking about his new book. It's called Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. And again, our guests are joining us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe. He's a fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. I counted it up. I do believe this is his 10th book. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Stephen Kinzer about the CIA's secret mind control program during the Cold War called MK Ultra. And again, Stephen Kinzer's got a new book called Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA's Search for Mind Control. Let me play one more clip and then we'll get some callers. We've got some comments here as well. This is CIA Chief Psychologist John Gittinger on the MK Ultra years, and he's speaking to the CBC back in 1980.
There was continued pressure put upon anybody within the agency in connection with trying to explain or understand brainwashing. So we were charged with rather an elaborate attempt to try to find out chemical, psychological, any kind of means that people could use to influence the behavior of the people.
Let me get, looks like Dave from Fort Washington to join our conversation. And Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks
there.
For taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I am a long-time listener and love the show.
Thank you.
I don't mean to dispute anything Mr. Kinzer's brought up. I understand that he's the book. I came to the show late today, sorry. But I understand the book has some thing to discuss about Dr. Gottlieb's positive merits. And I am a great nephew of his.
Oh.
And spent some summers with him. Not extensively, but enough to have a bit of an impact to his later years in life when the CIA was done and he had kind of embarked on this more humanitarian way of living. He was a fascinating character to our family. He always treated us quite well. And I think the author probably refers to the fact that he had a second career as a speech pathologist and even helped my father with a speech problem that some other clinicians were not able to help him with. He's a very fascinating and complex person, as I'm sure the author knows.
Absolutely, Dave, and I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. And let me give Stephen Kinzer just a chance to respond to your comments. And I should say to our listeners that our guest does talk about Gottlieb's life after he leaves the CIA, doing a lot of humanitarian work. But I'll let you speak for yourself, Stephen Kinzer. Go ahead.
Fascinating and complex, definitely describes Sidney Gottlieb. What an interesting guy, and I so envy you for having had the chance to meet him, as I spent kind of years trying to figure out who he was. You know that towards the end of his life, according to many people that knew him then, he really did feel burdened by what he had done in the past. He refused to speak about it, but one of the journalists who knocked on his door during this period told me that he said he was a destroyed man. He was riddled with guilt. And the rabbi that knew him at the end of his life said later that maybe in retrospect he was as puzzled by what he had done as we were who began to find out about it. So I do think that toward the end of his life, he was burdened. But as you say, he spent his entire retirement trying to become the Sidney Gottlieb that he always thought he was, the humanitarian who tutored children with speech defects and worked at the hospice and was a great community father. So he was troubled because anybody who believes in final judgment or karmic payback would have to be a little bit unquiet when looking back over a life like his.
Dave, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Stephen, let's just move our story forward. So I guess it's during President Nixon, CIA Director Helms is removed by Nixon, and I guess Gottlieb, loses his protector at that point, and he's then fired by Schlesinger.
So you're right. In 1973, Richard Helms, who had been Gottlieb's protector through his entire more than 20-year career at the CIA, suddenly found himself out as head of the CIA. Soon afterward, Gottlieb was let go, and he went on to this this new life. But on the way out the door, he and Helms had a conversation in which they agreed that all the records of MKUltra should be destroyed. Mm. And Gottlieb personally went out to the CIA archive in Warrenton, Virginia, to supervise that. And the protocol for that night shows that the archivist writes, 7 crates of MKUltra documents were destroyed over my stated objection. So he even checked with higher authorities. But with that, a huge archive was lost. And in my book, maybe my favorite line comes at the very end. I write, everything that's in this book is true. But not everything that's true is in this book. Yeah. So I'm painfully aware that I've only discovered a small part of what MKUltra was and who Sidney Gottlieb was.
Let me play something from the 1975 Church Committee hearings. And in this clip, a Republican Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee is questioning then CIA Director William Colby about Sidney Gottlieb's destruction of secret documents about this MKUltra program.
No one has interviewed Gottlieb as to why he destroyed the material or what they contained, the records.
No, we have not interviewed him as to the reason.
You know what material, what documents he destroyed?
We're very unsure as to the total. We do not have an inventory of them.
Do you think they might have said who it was authorized the formulation or the retention of this stuff? Do you have any reason to think it might or might not contain that information?
In this case, I doubt that it would have very much, because this case indicates, from the evidence we have at hand.
Does it say anything, have any reason to think that it might say how, if at all, this material was used in an aggressive way against someone to kill someone?
Well, there may well be some of that in the
when was period. When was the documentation destroyed?
In 1973.
It didn't happen to be destroyed at the same time those tapes. At the
1972.
Right. When in 1972?
In November, I believe it was.
In November of 72. Right. Do you have any idea what volume of records were destroyed?
I do not know.
Do you know who authorized the destruction, if anyone?
As I said, there was a memorandum of agreement between the director and Mr. Gottlieb at that time.
And the director at that time was?
Mr. Helms.
So Stephen Kinzer, obviously not everything was destroyed.
That's right. So I've found a number of sources from which I've been able to try to piece together this story. And some of them are CIA documents. So it turned out that at another depot where CIA financial records are kept. There were a number of expense account reports from operatives of MK Ultra. From these reports and other sources, it was possible to reconstruct what many of these 149 sub-projects were. But the clip that you played reflects something that worked to Gottlieb's favor in his later life. The senators who questioned him, and he had to go through two private sessions. He was allowed to do this in a private room of questioning by senatorial investigators, never really understood what MKUltra was.
Oh, interesting.
They didn't know what were the right questions to ask him. So if they had known what was in my book now, what we now know, the questions would have been a lot tougher. But nobody was ever able to penetrate the heart of Gottlieb's mystery while he was alive.
An email from Richard: Is it public knowledge yet the identities of the MKUltra experiments? I mean, clearly you and frankly others have written about this as well. Is there litigation on behalf for compensation, which does get us to this complicated story having to do with Frank Olson? And this was actually, I saw this documentary by Errol Morris called Wormwood, and Olson's family, his sons, I believe sons plural, do believe that he committed suicide as a result of MK Ultra.
The Frank Olson story is one of the most fascinating ones in the MK Ultra history. So Gottlieb worked with a very small group of chemists because, of course, it was the ultra secret. If news got out that the U.S. government was carrying out experiments like this, the entire CIA would have been devastated, and the loss of prestige for the U.S. would have been incalculable. So the secret had to be kept very tight. But sure enough, in the summer of 1953, one of the chemists in Gottlieb's inner circle had an attack of conscience. He was a guy named Frank Olson, who specialized in making aerosol poisons. During the summer of 1953, he did what these chemists often did, which was to travel to Europe or elsewhere to watch prisoners being experimented upon. And during this trip in the summer of 1953, Frank Olson apparently saw people being tortured and possibly tortured to death using toxins that he, Olson, had created. And somehow something snapped in him. This affected him. And he told this to other people that worked in the program. When he came back to Washington, he told people at the CIA in his own little group, "I want to quit. I want to leave the CIA." And later on, it turned out that he had even asked one of his friends, "Do you know a good journalist?" So on a November evening in 1953, a few months after returning from his trip to Europe, Frank Olson went out the window of a 13th floor hotel room in New York City and plunged to his death. This was reported as the suicide of an army scientist. Well, he was not an army scientist. And now, after exhuming the body and carrying out a series of other tests and experiments, the family has become convinced that actually he didn't go crazy because he was given LSD, or he didn't become melancholy and depressed and jump out the window. But he was helped out the window because the CIA was afraid that he was going to reveal the ultra secret of what Sidney Gottlieb and his comrades were doing.
Do you have a position on that? Do you think they're correct, incorrect? It's sort of unclear at this point.
The evidence is very strong, but it's for murder, but it's all circumstantial. There's no direct evidence. So putting everything together, looking at the report by the detective who's been in the room and shows how impossible it would have been to get to the right amount of speed and make your way through that tiny little window and run across the room. And he asks, why wouldn't the guy just have opened the window and just slipped out instead of trying that big Superman move? And then the finding that there was a heavy blow over the forehead in the body that was dug up years later, because the CIA at the beginning had told the family, you can't look at the body because it's too mutilated. All of this adds up to a great deal of suspicion. But I can tell you, the New York City medical examiner right now is considering a request from the family to reclassify that death from cause unknown to homicide. And if that happens, we'll see another piece of the MK Ultra story opening up again.
Well, it keeps going on and on and on. One of the things that strikes me, and it's patently obvious, on the one hand, you've got untrained people who are giving drugs to unwitting victims. On the other hand, you've got trained people, professionals, who are also engaging in these experiments. But these experiments not only didn't work, they're really bad experiments because you don't have a control group. I mean, it didn't follow any of the sort of rules and regulations about how you're supposed to conduct science.
You're absolutely right. From a scientific standpoint, MKUltra was laughable. They never had people who were truly qualified to assess behavior. This idea of this obese, bald drug agent sitting behind the mirror watching experiments and making notes while he's sitting on the toilet is almost the epitome of the scientific rigor with which these experiments were carried out. So although they were considering themselves scientists, they were actually working in a realm of complete fantasy. And this was something that in the end many of them finally realized. But by that time, countless lives had already been destroyed.
Yeah. Here's Suzanne from Pottstown joining us on Radio Times. And Suzanne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
I'm going to call this past as prologue. And do you believe anything like this is going on today in some form or another? The propaganda or Ed Snowden's revelations, or we lose our privacy? Isn't that a form of control?
Hmm. Interesting. Suzanne, thanks for the call. Stephen Kinzer, what do you think?
First of all, I think it's true that, as many writers have suggested, that things like mass psychology and advertising and mass media are their own forms of mind control, as are social media. But beyond that, I just want to address the first part of the caller's question about what could be happening today. I tell you, having spent years now immersed in this Gottlieb MKUltra project, I keep asking myself, how could it be that all of this could have been carried out behind the curtain of the facade of what this public politics and public diplomacy that we see? You cannot ask yourself that question so many times without asking yourself whether that might not be happening now. What's the difference? In fact, the technologies have vastly improved since Gottlieb's time. And you can also say something else has changed in a big way. In Gottlieb's time, there were only three or four people who knew what he was doing, and they supervised everything if they wanted to. Now, there isn't even anybody that knows half of what the U.S. government is doing in mass surveillance and all those surveillance state activities that are out there. Plus, although mind control is a myth and doesn't exist with all of the tools that we know about the brain now, as we advance into cyber technology and very advanced computer applications that we are not even imagining now, which could happen in a relatively short time, maybe that calculation will change. So it would be foolish not to believe that there could easily be in 50 years somebody like me sitting in a studio like this talking about some crazy experiment that was going on in 2019, but that reporters then were too dumb to be able to figure out.
Well, I have so many leftover questions. We've got about a minute, but can we make a if not direct line, a dotted line between some of Gottlieb's experiments and what happened at Abu Ghraib or even Guantanamo Bay or some of these black sites during the Iraq War?
Absolutely. It's a direct line. So Gottlieb wrote a long memo about techniques of interrogation. What had he learned from years of efforts around the world trying to find ways to make people who were victims of interrogation lose all contact with the outside world and become totally reliant on the interrogator? That writing became the basis for manuals that were used by the U.S. Army in the Phoenix program in Vietnam, run by the CIA. Also, they became the basis for manuals that the CIA wrote and circulated to police forces in Latin America in the 1980s. And some of those same techniques find their ways into manuals that were used to guide interrogators at places like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. In some cases, Gottlieb's phrases from the 50s are still identifiable in these new manuals. So the techniques that we now call enhanced interrogation owe a great deal to MKUltra. You could argue that although he failed to find the key to mind control, he definitely gave us some great insights into torture that the CIA is still using today.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, we've got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's good to leave you on such a happy note. Thanks for having me.
I was going to say, I was hoping there was another minute or two, but no, there isn't. His book is called Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.